Lately, I've had purpose on my mind. What motivates me to make the decisions that I do? When I act, who am I acting for? Or in terms of poetry, why is this author writing this poem? Published poets write, among many other reasons, to be read and understood by an audience. And how does one connect with masses of readers that they don't know? They must capture an experience or emotion with which the readers can share. That's one reason why I find food such a compelling poetic theme. The comfort of a favorite home-cooked meal, the routine coming together at the dinner table, it's a universal experience, and food wraps up so many memories in its tastes and smells. In this episode, we'll look at how five different poets communicate ideas about connection and loss, life and death, using themes of cooking and eating. So, here's food in poems. Our first poem is written and read by Joy Harjo. It's called Perhaps the World Ends Here.
Perhaps the world ends here. The world begins at a kitchen table. No matter what, we must eat to live. The gifts of earth are brought and prepared, set on the table. So it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens or dogs away from it. Babies teeth at the corners. They scrape their knees under it. It is here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it. We make women. At this table, we gossip, recall enemies and the ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh with us at our poor, falling down selves, and as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. This table has been a house in the rain, an umbrella in the sun. Wars have begun and ended at this table. It is a place to hide in the shadow of terror, a place to celebrate the terrible victory. We have given birth on this table and have prepared our parents for burial here. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse. We give thanks. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite.
The next poem is Oystering by Richard Howard.
Messieurs, l'huître et toi bonne. Adieu. Vivez en paix. Boileau. Gentlemen, the oyster was good. Farewell. Live in peace. Boileau.
Secret they are, sealed, annealed, and brainless and solitary, as Dickens said. But they have something to say, that there is more than one way to yield. The first, and the hardest, the most nearly hindered, is when you pull them off the rocks. A stinking, sawing sedge, sucking them back under the black mud, full of hermit crabs and their borrowed snail shells. Minnows scattering like superstitions, the surf dragging, and every power life permits them holding out, holding on for dear life. Sometimes the stones give way first, before they will, but still we gather them, even if our hands are bloody as meat. For a lunch, Queen Victoria preferred a barrel of Wellfleet oysters, points down, could last across the ocean, all the way to Windsor, wakening a widow's taste. We ate them this afternoon, out of their armor that was formidably grooved, though it proved our own reversal wiser still. Keep the bones and stones inside, or never leave the sea. He was a brave man, Swift said, who first eat one. Even now, precedent of centuries is not always enough. Driving the knife into muscles that mold the valves so close to being impartial. Surrender when it comes, and it must come. Lavish after the first grudging release. Back there in the sea, the giving over of despair. This time makes me speculate. Like Oscar and oysters, I feel always slightly immortal when in the sea. What happens now we are out? Is the risk worthwhile for a potential pearl? No. What we're really after is the moment of release. The turn and tear of the blade that tightens, tortures, ultimately tells. When you spread the shells, something always sticks to the wrong one, and a few drops of liquor dribble into the sand. Scrape it off, and the full half, as well as a fautrière, a Zen garden, and the smell of herring brine that Ferenczi said we remember from the womb. Lunch is served in shiny stoneware sockets, blue milk in the sea's filthiest cup. More easily an emblem for the inner man than dinner, sundered for the stomach. We take them queasily, wonder as we gulp, when it is. Then, now, tomorrow, they're dead.
This next poem, Scrapple, is named after the American food popular particularly in the mid-Atlantic region. A loaf of pork scraps and trimmings mixed with cornmeal and flour, and pan-fried in slices. It is written and will be read by Afa Michael Weaver.
It was Cousin Alvin who stole the liquor, slipped down Aunt Mabie's steps on the ice, fresh from jail for some small crime. Alvin liked to make us laugh while he took the liquor or other things we did not see. And Aunt Mabie's with her floors polished, wood she polished on her hands and knees until they were truth itself and slippery enough to trick you. Aunt Mabie, who loved her Calvert Extra and loved the bright inside of family, the way we come connected to webs born in clusters of promises, dotted with spots that mark our place in the karma of good times in the long ribbon of being colored. I learned when colored had just given way to Negro, and Negro was leaving us because blackness chased it out of the house, made it slip on the ice, fall down and spill N-E-G-R-O all over the sidewalk until we were proud in a new avenue of pride. As thick as a scrapple on Saturday morning with King's syrup. In the good times between the strikes and layoffs at the mills when work was too slack and Pop sat around pretending not to worry, not to let the stream of sweat he wiped from his head be anything except the natural way of things, keeping his habits, the paper in his chair by the window, the radio with the Orioles, with Earl Weaver the screamer, and Frank Robinson, the gentle black man, keeping his habits, Mama keeping hers, the WSID gospel in the mornings, dusting the encyclopedias she got from the A&P, collecting the secrets of neighbors, holding marriages together, putting golden silence on children who took the wrong turns, broke the laws of getting up and getting down on your knees. These brittle things we call memories rise up like the aroma of scrapple, beauty and ugliness, life's mix where the hard and painful things from folk who know no boundaries live beside the bright eyes that look into each other, searching their pupils for paths to prayer.
This poem is Marblehead by Rebecca Lindenberg.
Not to be in love with you, I can't remember what it was like. It must have been lousy. James Schuyler.
You take off your black motorcycle jacket, hang it on the back of a chair. It's cold from our walk along the seawall. Your pockets jingle with shells. While we were gone, you left the stove on low. Some things you do make me so nervous. You graze the surface of sauce simmering in a pan, shiny fingertip held out for me to lick. You say, what does it need? Maybe nothing, maybe honey to unbitter the lime. Later that night, you'll bury your face in my belly and sob, I'm sorry, though I don't think you are always talking to me, my love. But now, lobster steam billows up the window, you gulp purple wine, your pinky sticking out, and the round olives are the green, all green things aspire to be. Our last poem is Eating Together by Lee Young Lee. In the steamer is the trout, seasoned with slivers of ginger, two sprigs of green onion, and sesame oil. We shall eat it with rice for lunch, brothers, sister, my mother who will taste the sweetest meat of the head, holding it between her fingers deftly, the way my father did weeks ago. Then he lay down to sleep, like a snow-covered road winding through pines older than him, without any travelers, and lonely for no one. Food is fundamental, and as a universal need, it allows poets to explore a wide range of emotions through the lens of something we all know. These poems demonstrate how the connection between food and poetry transcends time and culture. The sensory language associated with food, its taste, smells, textures, and colors, provides a palette for creating rich and immersive pieces that resonate with the readers. The effectiveness of food as a poetic theme lies in its ability to tap into shared human emotion. Food can represent the warmth of family gatherings, the intimacy of cooking together, or the comforting embrace of culture, community, and tradition. As Joy Harjo and Lee Young Lee write, the kitchen table sees everything. It is a place for family and friends to gather, to eat in celebration of life, and in mourning death. Poems like Oystering and Marblehead honor the beauty of harvest and preparation, of the creatures we eat, and the rituals we adopt in cooking them. At the same time, this theme can also illuminate the darker aspects of human experience, such as hunger, deprivation, and struggle. They rise, in the words of Afa Michael Weaver, like the aroma of scrapple, sweet but salty and heavy, a mix of beauty and pain, like all of life's memories. Like the complexity of family, trauma, of identity. By weaving the theme of food throughout their verses, poets invite readers to embark on a sensory journey that transcends the printed page. In this way, food serves as a powerful bridge between the poet's inner world and the reader's own experiences, allowing the authors to convey feelings and images from their own lives in one nourishing bite.